And Radio Derb is on the air. This is your viscerally genial host, John Derbyshire, with some lowlights from the week's news. This week's podcast is structured, ladies and gents, like a classical symphony. The first few segments are straight reporting of news stories, with only the barest minimum of snarky asides, irrelevant digressions, and scatological double entendres. Only then, having delivered the news, shall I descend into opinionated commentary. Structure. Hey, it's not sonata form, but then I'm not Franz Josef Haydn. I just use his music. Okay, let's see how it goes. I don't know much about Yale University. The closest I ever got was back in my days as a professional dishwasher for Robbins and Robbins Kosher Caterers of New Rochelle. We catered an event at a synagogue in New Haven. A wedding, I think it was. I do hold Yale in some esteem. Jared Taylor, one of my culture heroes, went there. So, of course, did Bill Buckley. Whether Yale did those gents any positive good, I can't say, not having known them before they went to Yale. But it didn't seem to have done them any harm. Whatever. Yale's in the news. Americans of a certain age will recall the Berkeley free speech movement of 50 years ago. Well, the folks at Yale just heard about that, and they decided to have a disturbance of their own. A free screech movement. Let's hear the screech. Then we'll do some analysis. The screech.
Be quiet for all standing students. You understand that? As your position as master, it is your job to create a place of comfort and home for the students that live in Silliman. You have not done that. By sending out that email, that goes against your position as master. Do you understand that?
No, I don't agree with that.
Then why the fuck did you accept the position?
Who the fuck hired you? I have a different vision.
You should step down. If that is what you think about being a master, you should step down. It is not about creating an intellectual space. It is not. Do you understand that? It's about creating a home here. You are not doing that.
You're supposed to be our advocate.
You should be at the event last night when you hear her Franco say that she doesn't know how to create a safe space for her freshmen in Silliman. How do you explain that? These freshmen probably have, they think this is what Yale is? Do you hear that? They're going to leave. They're going to transfer because you are a poor steward of the community. You should not sleep at night.
We're out.
You are disgusting.
Okay, that's the screech. Here's a rundown on the location and the dramatis personae there. The location was an open space somewhere on the Yale campus. The confrontation happened on Friday, November 6th. The screecher is a Yale undergraduate, a senior, named Geraldine Luther. Her major is either history or political science, I'm not sure. Geraldine's a mulatto from an upper-middle-class family in Fairfield, Connecticut. Fairfield is a Tony Whiteopia, just 1.7% black. Median household income in 2013, over $105,000. Average price for a detached house that year, $724,000. Geraldine's own family home on Whiting Pond Road, Whiting, I like that, is appraised at $761,000. Geraldine's mom runs a public relations firm. That's the screecher. The screechee is Nicholas Christakis, a Yale professor, who seems to be both a biologist and a sociologist. Christakis is a white guy, 53 years old. His wife Erica lectures at the university. As well as their academic duties, Mr. and Mrs. Christakis supervise Silliman College. That's one of Yale's residential facilities. Miss Luther is one of the students residing at Silliman. Okay, so the mulatto student has an issue with the white master of her residential hall. Plainly, we're in Raceland here. What was the issue? Did someone burn a cross on the campus at Yale? No, that's not the issue. Although, if anyone at Yale is into cross-burning, there's a contractor in my town who'll make up a really nice cross for you. Creosoted wood. Burns a treat. Oh, that's by the by. No, the issue here was that Yale, or to be precise, the Intercultural Affairs Committee at Yale, that's the administrative unit responsible for soothing the feelings of out-of-their-depth affirmative action admissions, the Intercultural Affairs Committee sent out a campus-wide email warning students to be sensitive when selecting their Halloween costumes. Sample quote. Halloween is, unfortunately, a time when the normal thoughtfulness and sensitivity of most Yale students can sometimes be forgotten, and some poor decisions can be made, including wearing feathered headdresses, turbans, wearing war paint, or modifying skin tone, or wearing blackface or redface. These same issues and examples of cultural appropriation and or misrepresentation are increasingly surfacing with representations of Asians and Latinos. End quote. Now, believe it or not, there are adults at Yale who push back against all this exquisite sensitivity. Mrs. Christakis is one such. She emailed the students under her care at Silliman College, pushing back ever so gently against the administration's Halloween honk. Sample quote from her email. American universities were once a safe space not only for maturation, but also for a certain regressive or even transgressive experience. Increasingly, it seems, they have become places of censure and prohibition. End quote. And that's it. That's what the screeching is about. An upper-middle-class young woman attending a prestigious Ivy League university is outraged by the suggestion that she might have to endure a, quote, regressive or even transgressive experience of the order of seeing someone in blackface at a Halloween party. I should add that there are some side issues here. Rumours have been going around the campus of racial incidents. There is, as usual, no evidence for any of them. And on the track record for this kind of thing, we can be sure at around the 99% level that if there is actual substance to any of the rumours, the perp would turn out to be a minority student desperate to manufacture some victimhood for himself. The phrases campus race incident and campus race hoax are, to a very high approximation, synonymous. What do we learn from this, comrades? Well, I'll postpone the learning experience to later. First, a little more reportage. That November 6th confrontation between Professor Christakis and Ms. Luther has been bouncing around the internet all week, and everyone's had something to say about it. A few of my favourites from the tweetosphere. One, Someone at Harvard is printing up T-shirts with the message, Yale, not an intellectual space. The website promises that these T-shirts will be available in quantity in time for the Harvard-Yale football game on November 21st. 2. A columnist at the Daily Beast, quote, if you hate seeing your kid grow up, for $50,000 a year, we can transform your teenager back into a fucking baby. End quote. The columnist there, one Michael Moynihan, is not otherwise known to me, but I'll be glad to buy him a drink if our paths should cross. 3. The very witty blogger who calls himself Iowa Hawk, quote, let's make tomorrow hashtag National Offend a College Student Day, end quote. 4. Isaac Cohen, who is actually an undergraduate at Yale and an occasional columnist for the Yale Daily News, quote, in the racial brouhaha at Yale are the seeds of understanding our student debt problem. Useless schools, useless majors, useless students, end quote. I'm not going to disagree, Isaac, but isn't that sort of calling down fire on your own position? Okay, that's a few of my favourite comments. Meanwhile, at Yale itself, the whole business is being taken with utmost seriousness. From the Yale Daily News, November 12th, quote, crammed into pews and lined up against the walls, members of the Yale community filled Battelle Chapel past its 1,100-person capacity on Wednesday evening for a moment of crisis, race at Yale teach-in, a forum dedicated to educating the community about the issues faced by people of colour at Yale. End quote. So let me get this straight. You're black, or mulatto, or possibly a quadroon or a Hayala, from some tony upper middle class enclave like Fairfield, Connecticut. You got affirmative actioned into Yale, elbowing aside some white coal miner's kid from West Virginia with 200 more SAT points than you have. Now, you're on the fast track to a high slot in our affirmative actionocracy, the most pampered, favoured, fawned over, and, yes, privileged group of people that ever existed, possibly excepting the pre-revolution French aristocracy. You'll have some make-work job in the government handed to you, or take the diversity spot in some law firm or media outlet. You've got it made. And you're facing issues? What issues? The Yale cafeteria's arugula salad was limp? The Veuve Clicquot was insufficiently chilled? Let me continue this report from the Yale Daily News. Quote, the teach-in, which followed more than a week of open forums, discussions and rallies in response to racial controversies on campus. Sorry, this is me interrupting again. I just want to interpret the phrase racial controversies on campus for you. Meaning, someone thought he heard someone say they heard that someone had overheard someone say that he'd heard a black kid was turned away from a private party. No, it really doesn't chill my blood either, but it fills the Yale chapel. Okay, continuing the quote. The teach-in was organised by the university's four cultural centres. The Afro-American Cultural Centre, the Native American Cultural Centre, the Asian American Cultural Centre, and La Casa Cultural. Interrupting again here, I think I know what they do at the Afro-American Cultural Center. Eat chitlins and sing gospel songs, right? What goes on at the Asian American Cultural Center, though? Is that where Vietnamese guys go to pick up Pakistani girls, or what? I just don't get the whole Asian American thing. Never mind. Continuing. The three-hour event was primarily composed of four panels, which discussed topics that included valuing women of color at Yale, mental health and its impacts on communities of color, addressing white and male privilege, and the importance of taking ethnic studies classes. Me again, interrupting. Can you imagine sitting through 3 hours of that? 3 hours of upper-class blacks and feminists whining? That's got to be about as much fun as the all-night dentist. Skipping forward a bit, did we get white ethnomasochists squirming with fake guilt? We sure did. Quote, in the panel about white and male privilege, the panelists, who included white men and men of colour, shared their experiences with understanding systemic racism. Some admitted that they had been blind to issues of systematic racism growing up, while others urged white men to acknowledge and understand that they are products of the structure of white privilege. End quote. I should say that the president of Yale himself was there doing the full multi-culti grovel. Quote from him. I think there are so many voices that can be inspiring to the Yale community that we don't hear regularly, either because they aren't listened to or because they're speaking from the margins, and I think it's very much time to place them. End quote. No, that wasn't your local kindergarten principal. That was the president of Yale University. Heaven help this republic. I was going to finish the segment there, but I can't resist just one more story from the Yale Daily News. Once you start reading their reports, the thing gets a grip on your attention somehow, like a really gruesome car wreck. This is a different story from the November 11th issue. The Yale Political Union held a debate on affirmative action. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Making the case against affirmative action was University of Pennsylvania law professor Amy Wax, with whom I was once honoured to share a public platform. I'll just quote you this snippet from the Yale Daily News. Quote, during Wax's speech, about a dozen members of the union rose and walked to the back of the room, where they turned their backs on Wax and raised their fists in the air. Several students cried during her speech. End quote. Did you get that last sentence? Several students cried during her speech. You could carve that on Western civilization's tombstone. Here's another university president, Tim Wolf, president of the University of Missouri. He's a white guy, 57 years old. He was, I should have said. Mr. Wolf resigned his position last Tuesday. R. Bowen Loftin, Chancellor of the University's Columbia campus, announced that he'd be resigning too. What's up with all that? This started back in September. Peyton Head, that's his name, Peyton Head, a dark-skinned homosexual black guy at the Columbia campus, majoring in political science and international studies, complained on Facebook that someone in a passing pickup truck off campus had yelled "nigger" at him. He was, of course, believed. When has anyone ever been known to lie about something like that? Then, late in October, university police fielded a complaint that someone had smeared poop in the shape of a swastika on a bathroom wall in one of the university dorms. A shysticker, one wit has called it. Presumably this was human poop. This may actually have happened. Nobody took a picture, which is a little odd in the smartphone age, but the officer who responded wrote up a report in which he says he saw the offending artwork. It's a small dorm. I think the bathroom serves just 5 people, so it shouldn't be hard to find the perp. But if the college authorities know who did it, they're keeping shtum. They're holding it in, you might say. Mighty oaks from little acorns grow, and from these ambiguous stories there swelled a mighty chorus of indignation. One black student, an education major, started a hunger strike on November 3rd, claiming that the college authorities hadn't done enough about all the racism. This hunger striker, by the way, name of Jonathan Butler, is another pampered pet of privilege. From the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, November 11th, quote, "He is a member of a prominent Omaha family. Butler's father is Eric L. Butler, executive vice president for sales and marketing for the Union Pacific Railroad. His 2014 compensation was $8.4 million, according to regulatory filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission." End quote. I'd say that casts some doubt on the sincerity of the guy's hunger strike. Just waft some scent of lobster bisque into the tent, I bet he'd fold. Then, last Monday, the black players on the college football team took a break from consulting with their lawyers about plea bargaining down their rape charges to announce that they were going on football strike, refusing to train or play until President Wolf resigned. So, President Wolf resigned, and Chancellor Loftin followed suit. An interim president has been named, and he is, of course, a black guy. There were some sidebar items to the Missouri story. A freelance photographer on assignment for ESPN was insulted and shoved on Monday by protesters. The shovers included a faculty member mellifluously named Melissa Click, a white lady, a professor of communications, teaching courses with titles like, actual course title, Television Program Analysis and Criticism. Reading that, I thought of the military recruiter in Starship Troopers, going over Rico's high school transcript and saying, quote, "A boy who gets a C- in appreciation of television can't be all bad." Tuesday, the campus police emailed all students with guidelines on, quote, "reporting hateful and or hurtful speech," end quote. Guideline number one, quote, "Call the police immediately at 573-882-7201. If you are in an emergency situation, dial 911. End quote. Let me repeat that so it sinks in. The University of Missouri, a fully accredited institution of higher education here in the United States of America, instructs its students to call the cops if someone hurts their feelings. And you still don't think we're doomed? On Wednesday, Peyton Head, That's the homosexual black student government president, the one who complained about the pickup truck incident, had posted on Facebook that there had been a Ku Klux Klan sighting on campus. Campus police denied this. There was, of course, no evidence, and Head retracted the claim. So, racial ructions all over on our college campuses. Before I get to analysis, just a couple more stories, both non-campus related. This story comes from Europe. I'm sure I don't need to tell listeners that Europe is being flooded with illegal aliens from Africa and the Middle East. Around 800,000 have arrived so far this year, of whom around a quarter are from Africa, most from sub-Saharan Africa. The official jargon for these illegals is asylum seekers. That is, they claim to be fleeing from persecution. In practice, only a microscopic minority truly match that description. The great majority just want to move from their poor, crappy, misgoverned countries to the much nicer nations of Northern Europe, nations that Europeans have patiently built up for themselves and their posterity over many centuries of constitutional trial and error. What's supposed to happen is the authorities in European countries investigate each arrival. Those who can prove persecution get asylum. Those who can't are sent back whence they came. Here we hit a problem. Africa has way too many people, far more than there are jobs for. African countries don't want their illegals back any more than Mexico wants theirs. Like Mexico, these African countries would much prefer their illegals stay in the countries they have illegally entered. For one thing, that relieves African rulers of the problem of unemployed and disgruntled young men in troublesome quantities. And for another, the illegals, once settled in Europe, send cash remittances back to their home countries. For these messed-up, poverty-stricken nations, remittances are a major source of national revenue. This week saw a big diplomatic effort to solve the problem. There was a meeting in Malta between the European Council and the heads of several African countries. The European Council, I should explain, is basically the leaders of all the EU nations, with an ex-leader added as chairman. An American equivalent would be the governors of all the states, chaired by some ex-governor who's avoided jail, if you can find one. So, there they were, all these European and African leaders meeting in Malta, a little Mediterranean island state that is an EU member. It's nothing to do with the story, but I can't forbear noting that Maltese is the only Semitic language written with the Latin alphabet. How did things go? Not well. The Europeans were basically saying to the Africans, you have to take back your illegals and prevent any more from coming. Illegals getting to be a big thing with our pesky electorates. The Africans, in response, were saying, all right, but it'll cost you. The way it shook out, the euros couldn't meet the Africans' price. The Africans were especially unwilling to take back their illegals. Key phrase from the conference report by Donald Tusk, the European chairman, quote, we will facilitate returns, preferably voluntary, by a number of concrete steps, such as African immigration officials travelling to Europe to help verify and identify the nationalities of irregular migrants. End quote. Let me just translate that phrase, preferably voluntary. Translation, we promise not to deport anybody. While I'm at it, let me also translate the phrase, African immigration official for you. Translation. Even this nothing burger is going to cost the Euros $2 billion. They're going to have to bid way higher than that to get rid of their African illegals. I beg your pardon, asylum seekers. Asylum seekers. And Africa is only half the EU's problem. The other half is Turkey. The situation here is fundamentally the same. The Euros want Turkey to stop sending illegals. The Turks have an asking price. So there's to be another conference with Turkey later this month. Will it go any better than this one did? That depends on whether the EU can grow a spine in 2 weeks. I don't believe this has ever been known to happen in biology, so the prospects are not good. Just one more news story before I get to the snarling vituperation. Oh, sorry, I mean thoughtful editorialising. This week encompassed Veterans Day, or Armistice Day, as I grew up calling it. When you brought up the Google search screen that day, you saw one of their date-relevant doodles. The doodle showed 7 veterans in uniform. Only 2 of the 7 were unambiguously white, and both were female. 2 were clearly black, 1 male and 1 female. Among the others, 1, another male, was clearly meant to be Hispanic. They didn't put a sombrero on him, but he was brown with a mustache. Oh wait, mustache? Perhaps he's also the homosexual token. Whatever. Of the remaining 2, 1 was vaguely mulatto and the other yellowish, and so I guess East Asian. This Google doodle generated much ridicule. It was, people said, wildly at statistical odds with the actual veterans population. Was that so? Let's investigate. The Federal Department of Veterans Affairs has a statistics office, and that office has a website. And from that website, you can download spreadsheets analysing the veteran population. Well, you can if you have a lot of patience. As always with federal websites, the rule is good enough for government work. I just did that. And I learned that as at September 30th this year, there were an estimated 21,680,534 veterans. If you cut them by race to the nearest percentage, there are 77% non-Hispanic white, 12% black, 7% Hispanic, 4% other. The breakdown by sex is male 91%, female 9%. I'm shocked to report that the VA spreadsheet offers no other options for sex. 9% of 7 is 0.63. So, if you're going to show 7 people in your veteran's doodle, 1 female would be an extremely generous allocation. Race-wise, you'd want at least 5 white faces. 1 black would be generous. 1 Hispanic would be extravagantly generous. Asians and Apaches, forget about it. Are the folks at Google perhaps influenced away from statistical truth by the diversity within the company itself? Let's investigate that. Just this summer, Google issued a report on the composition of their workforce. If you go to the website, www.google.com/diversity, You have to wade through a lot of happy, smiley propaganda text and pictures about inclusiveness and such, and then you get to actual numbers, separated into tech and non-tech employees. What do we got? Tech, 59% white, 1% black, 2% Hispanic, 38% other. 35 of that 38 are Asian. Non-tech, so now we're bringing in the janitors and the mailroom staff, as well as, of course, all the wonderful people who work in Google's Office of Diversity and Inclusion. Non-tech, the numbers are 64% white, 4% black, 4% Hispanic, 28% other, with 23 of the 28% Asian. Sex-wise, Google's tech workforce is 82% male. The non-tech side is 53% male. Again, it is distressing to report that no other sex categories are shown. Get with the program, people! So no, that doodle isn't reflecting Google's own workforce. What it reflects a bit more closely is the faces shown in that propaganda section at the front of the report. Of the 9 faces there, 2 are black for 22%. 4 are female, that's 44%. That, in fact, takes you to the heart of the matter. The Veterans Day Google Doodle is also propaganda. It is, in fact, to use one of my current favourite expressions, virtue signalling, formerly known to theologians as cheap grace. You put out a smokescreen of virtuous images to show the world what a good, good person you are. Then you go home to your other sex partner in your 1% black gated whiteopia. Hypocrisy, some dead white guy said, hypocrisy is the homage that vice pays to virtue. Not anymore. Today, hypocrisy is the homage that white liberals pay to the gods of diversity. Okay, enough with the news stories. What do they teach us? The big thing they teach us is, to quote from the title of a column I wrote 3 years ago, that white people are pussies. Perhaps that's a bit unkind, not to mention a bit ethno-masochistic. Of course, not all white people are pussies. I know some white people who are not pussies. Heck, one of them's running for president. For sure, though, a lot of white people are pussies. And that lot includes well-nigh all white liberals. That in turn includes, as a subset, practically all white employees in college administration. Pussy-wise, actual college faculties are a bit more, how shall I say it, diverse. In the science and math departments, my experience has been that while a vague liberalism predominates, most faculty just want to get on with juggling quarks or proving theorems and don't want to be distracted by all the political nonsense. The professional schools are similar, but with a higher pussification quotient. The humanities are pretty solidly, I guess a better qualifier here would be fluffily, pretty fluffily pussified. Yes, there are non-pussies in academia. The aforementioned Amy Wax, that UPenn law professor who made students cry by arguing against affirmative action in this week's Yale debate, Professor Wax is clearly not a pussy. Here's another case. Dale Brigham, an associate professor of nutrition and exercise physiology at the University of Missouri. Professor Brigham, who's a white guy, had scheduled an exam for early this week. That was, of course, just when the race business blew up, accompanied by a threat on social media from a white lunatic who said he'd go on a shooting rampage against blacks. Professor Brigham was urged to cancel the exam so that students could cower weeping in their safe spaces. He refused, writing in an email to his students, quote, "If you give in to bullies, they win. The only way bullies are defeated is by standing up to them. If we cancel the exam, they win. If we go through with it, they lose." End quote. This was considered so outrageously insensitive, Professor Brigham felt obliged to resign. As we go to tape here, though, the university hasn't accepted his resignation. So, possibly, there are some non-pussies even in the administration there. Or possibly Professor Brigham has learned to love Big Brother and is right now installed naked in a barrel at the football team changing rooms. I don't know. So we're not all pussies. The pussification factor is high enough among whites, though, that non-whites and ethno-masochist white anarchists can get anything they want by targeting the plentiful supply of white pyjama boys and girly men and their female auxiliaries. In some cases, as the Google Doodle shows, the screechers and the anarchists don't actually have to do anything. The pyjama boys know what is expected of them and do it unprompted, either from commercial calculation or, heaven help us, from actual sincerity. And sometimes the price of pussification is just too high for total abject surrender, as was the case with the Europeans in Malta this week. Not that the price was high enough to turn the pussies into angry tigers. That never happens. It was, though, high enough for the Euros to drop their key demands, fudging over their retreat with weaselly blather about taking concrete steps and addressing root causes. What would the world look like if white people were not pussies? Or at least, if the pussified portion of the white population were a despised and impotent minority? Permit me to dream. That's meant to be dream music. Yes, in this segment, I am dreaming. Yale University, November 6th. Professor Christakis, when that potty-mouthed rich brat starts screeching at him, turns away grim-lipped and walks off to the university's administration office, where he files a request that she be punished for insulting and abusive behaviour towards a campus authority figure. The university swings into action. Potty Mouth is suspended for a year and barred from campus. Her fees for the year are forfeited. Professor Christakis shows up at the faculty Christmas party dressed as Nathan Bedford Forrest, to general applause. University of Missouri, November 8th. President Wolf announces that by agreement with his board and support from the Alumni Association and the state legislature, the college football team is to be disbanded, all football fixtures and training programs cancelled. Furthermore, the practice of bringing in low IQ students for the college sports teams and signing them up for BS courses like television program analysis and criticism in the pretense they are engaging in higher education will cease as of this semester. Mountain View, California, November 11th. Google Inc. has announced that it will abandon its diversity strategy. The company will no longer require employees to participate in unconscious bias workshops. Outreach programs to historically black colleges will be dropped, as will the partnership efforts with Hollywood studios to produce girl-friendly promotional movies about computer science. The Veterans Day Google Doodle shows the US Marines raising the flag on Iwo Jima. Malta, November 12th. Following the collapse of talks with African nations this week, the European Commission announced the following steps. 1. All foreign aid programs to African nations from the EU and its member states will cease forthwith. 2. Citizens of African nations found to be in EU countries illegally will be interned indefinitely in camps being constructed in the Svalbard archipelago in the Norwegian Arctic. 3. The African shores of the Mediterranean will be intensively patrolled by ships of member nations. Unauthorized vessels will be intercepted and towed back to the nearest shore point, where they will be destroyed. Should such boats scuttle, survivors will be incapacitated with wrist and ankle cuffs, loaded into steel-hulled landing craft and towed to shore. That's a sample of my dreams, listener. Not dreams of hate or harm, as the cultural Marxist propagandists will have you think. These are dreams of a fair and just world. In my dream world, no one lets his judgment be warped by racial guilt. In this world, no one is privileged on account of his race, and everyone understands that unequal outcomes by race are the fault of nobody but Mother Nature. In this world, elementary truths have not been forgotten. Truths like appeasing a bully only encourages him. And nations with open borders do not survive. All right, it's a dream world. And it's annoying to have other people tell you their dreams, I know. I'm sorry. Forgive me. Please forgive me. I will do anything if only you'll forgive me. I am so, so sorry. On behalf of all privileged cisgendered white males everywhere, I humbly apologize. Won't you forgive me? Please. Please forgive me. Here, take my money. Please, take it. This week's miscellany of brief items will have to be drastically truncated, I'm afraid, listeners. I'm way over time, and if I don't wind up quickly, I shall be late for the diversity and inclusion seminar that VDARE has signed up its employees for. I therefore only have time to note that the finals of the Miss Bum Bum pageant were held November 9th in Sao Paulo, Brazil. The Mail Online website offers full photographic coverage. The 15 finalists, each representing a Brazilian state, displayed their talents to a packed audience in various ways. Listeners may recall that a couple of weeks ago I had a crack at guessing the winner, and I settled my preference on Sabrina Boing Boing of Rio Grande do Sol. Well, Senorita Boing Boing enthralled the crowd by licking a baseball bat for quite a long time. Alas, it wasn't enough to sway the judges. The final winner was Susie Cortez of Distrito Federal. Poor Sabrina was left to bring up the rear. The show was rounded off with a coronation, of course. The pageant crown was placed on Senorita Cortez's... let me just do a quick fact check here. Yes, on her head. Congratulations, Susie. Commiserations, Sabrina. Try to put it behind you, dear. I'm sure we all look forward to next year's contest. That's it, ladies and gents. I am indeed way over time, so I'll just thank you for listening and urge you to tune in again next week when there will be more caustic commentary from Radio Derb.